Hi, everyone, and welcome to I'll Go First. I'm your host, Jessica Minhas. On this episode, Kevin Adler joins us. He is the CEO and founder of Miracle Messages. We talk about loving our neighbors who are experiencing homelessness, how relational brokenness can affect all of us, and how we can start rebuilding relationships with loved ones in our own lives. I think you're really going to like it. Enjoy. This is Kevin Adler. He is the CEO and founder of Miracle Messages. He is a social entrepreneur and a 2x author coming up soon.
I've thrown some words to paper and it's been shared a few times, but it's one of the things that has been a very important outlet for me when I've had less capacity for taking time to just reflect on the work and all that comes up with it. So writing is definitely part of my toolkit.
And it's really around shared trauma. One of your first books was really diving into that. And I love how that's kind of translated into Miracle Messages. Can you sort of encapsulate your passion and vision for it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So Miracle Messages is a nonprofit that helps people who are experiencing homelessness rebuild their social support systems. And I got started with this work 5.5 years ago. I had an uncle who was homeless, Uncle Mark. And, you know, he was just such a wonderful part of my family, you know, remembered every birthday, guest of honor, Thanksgiving, Christmas. And he also suffered from schizophrenia and lived on and off the streets of Santa Cruz for 30 years before he was found deceased at the age of 50. And so this person that I knew as such a dear member of my family had these seemingly two separate lives of when he was at our Christmas or Thanksgiving dinner table and when he was dropped off at the Greyhound station and went back to Santa Cruz. And so after he died, I just started wondering, why is it that the storytelling tools that we all rely on to build empathy for our experiences and to connect with our friends, you know, social media, smartphones, wearable cameras, why those tools seem seemingly inaccessible to people like my Uncle Mark? I'm a person of faith, and I got this question in my heart. Well, how would Jesus use a GoPro camera? Or how would Jesus use a smartphone or social media? And long story short, had over the course of a year, 24 people who are homeless volunteer to wear GoPro cameras around their chests and narrate their experience of what life is like on the streets. And when I got the footage back, I heard people in clip after clip say, you know, I never realized I was homeless when I lost my housing. Only when I lost my family and friends. And that really attuned me to this idea of relational poverty, relational brokenness that many people on the streets experience, an extreme form of isolation and disconnectedness. And just wondered, what would it look like to try to reconcile relationships while also rebuilding social support systems for where the people are currently based?
I love that. One quote that I found in a lot of your interviews was, and one theme that really was highlighted, and it made me think, you know, this is about homelessness, but it isn't, because it's more than that. In one other interview, you explained it as a nonprofit reunion service for neighbors, and that this is really about redemption in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I would agree with my words still. I'd agree with that. You do your homework, Jessica. I felt like an imposter when I started doing this work. I thought that I had to have been, marching in the streets for years and tweeting and posting about how homelessness is the human rights crisis of our day, which, sure, it is. It's one of many human rights crises in our day. But I didn't think I had enough focus on the issue. I said, I care about the environment, care about education, I care about, you know, democracy and equality. And for me, it became this broader perspective that it's not homelessness I care about, it's the intrinsic value of each person and the interconnectedness of us all. And here's this group of people that are, because their lack of one physical need, seen as less than in our society. And as a result, disconnected from the rest of us and defined by their lack of one need. So absolutely, it's been a journey, not only of transformation, perhaps of some of the clients' lives that we've helped reconnect to families, but for our own lives, myself, my team, many of our volunteers, to see people who are homeless, as we say, not as problems to be solved, but as people to be loved.
When did you realize that it was more than just reunion services and reunification?
Well, pretty early on, when I got started with this work, the first gentleman that I recorded a message from, you know, got reconnected to his family. And it was a beautiful story. He'd been disconnected for 22 years, a missing person for 12 years. A Facebook post went viral. His sister got tagged in 20 minutes. People from his town, hey, I went to high school with Jeffrey. I work in construction. Does he need a job? Does he need health care? And then turned out he had been a missing person for 12 years, right? So there's this image that I've held up as we've built the reunion service of this is what's possible. This is the need. There's people like Jeffrey in our midst who are totally disconnected with a social support system, just under the surface looking for him, going to bed every night, waking up every morning saying, where's my brother? Where's my uncle? Where's my son? If you want to reconnect and just say, hi, I miss you. I love you. I want you back in my life. I'm sorry. That's a really important starting point for relationships, even if you decide only to have that one conversation. If you decide to go move in together, that's beautiful too. But if people are really staying and that's their community, how do we strengthen social supports where people live?
When I hear you talk about relational poverty, I think of not just people who are experiencing homelessness, but just all of us who are trying to be in relationship to one another, and the good and the bad, and how uncomfortable that can be sometimes.
Yes. This is my experience too. Yeah. And in fact, just as a, you know, kind of building on that, it's sometimes people are sheepish to say things like what you just said about, well, you know, we all experience that, right? There's almost this like presumed, like different levels of suffering and of trauma, which absolutely there are, right? There could be first degree, proximal, you know, there's different levels, but suffering is still suffering. Pain is still pain. Hurt is still hurt. And there's so little to connect around with our neighbors experiencing homelessness, especially when we call them homeless people, because then we're just housed people. And it's like, where do you start? That I found in my own life, when I talk about my own bouts of feeling inadequate, feeling like I'm not good enough, pride, shame, loneliness, isolation, even if it's not at the same level or degree as a lot of our neighbors on the streets, it's still a starting point for sharing vulnerability, which when shared is such a catalyst for strength and solidarity. So I'm all about just showing up as you are and being very open and authentic, and especially getting away from the who needs help and who's the helper mindset, but really just being more on a level playing field as people.
We were talking about relational brokenness, and you had mentioned, you gave some really wise words. You said, let's take this little capsule of love, warmth, sorrow, and apology, and let's use that as a starting point to heal relational breakdown, to reconnect and rebuild. Can you speak a little bit more to that? Because I think there's so many lessons from the work you're doing that we can think through when we're thinking of relational brokenness.
Yeah. I mean, even the idea of relationship, I think presumption of like, well, it has to be a certain way. We have to get to this, because relationships are, you know, they ebb and they flow. I think with people on the streets, the only options for kind of reconciliation that's widely available is like, go live with your family, right? Like these programs, these one-way bus ticket programs, like it, as a means to get off the streets. Do you know how tight a relationship you and I would have to have for one of us to live in the other person's house, right? Like, I mean, we're friends, we trust each other.
Yeah, I would never even think about this. Yeah, that is such a massive
jump. It's a huge jump. It's impossible. And I think a better starting point for relationship is, how are you? I miss you. I'm sorry I said that to you. It really hurt my feelings when you did this. I want you to know I love you in spite of all the time that's passed. I think about you every day, right? It's like a good Willie Nelson song, right? You've been always on my mind, you know? I mean, come on. So I think that's what it means to be human and in relationship. But I think what we do is,
that's so scary.
What we do is we create that space where that person has the option, very light, no expectations, no pressure, to go first, say what they need to say, and then through an intermediary, try to deliver it in this compassionate way and invite the loved ones to respond and then go second or third or fourth, whatever it takes. And 80% of the time that we find the loved ones, they're excited to reconnect. So.
And you've reconnected about 250 About 330
through the reunion service, another 20 or 30 through Find Them, where the families reach out to us and then we go find the person experiencing homelessness. I have a homeless brother in San Francisco. Can you find them? Their name is Bob. And we've been able to reconnect about 20 or 25 of those families. But yeah, in total, about 350 reunions. Average time disconnected is about 15 years.
When we think about the relationships that have been able to come together in a positive way, why do you think that is? What components, what made that work, do you think?
It's a great question because I spend a lot more time thinking about what makes it not work and the reasons why people cite as, I don't want anything to do with this person. I think in the cases where it makes it work, if a person's kind of prevailing memory of someone is not just bad, you know, where it's, and it's not just that everything was bad, but, you know, we have cases sometimes that are heartbreaking where, you know, a parent wants to reconnect with the child. The child felt abandoned by the parents. And maybe the person, the father's, you know, their life, drugs and alcohol made it so they went through child protective services and the foster system and have had a rough time of that. Now, having that father come back and say, hey, 30 years later, you're now a, you know, a 30-year-old or whatever, 35-year-old, and my arms are open. I'd like to reconnect. It's understandable that the young person may not, the child may not be interested in that. You know, they may still be dealing with the consequences of the brokenness that existed before. But either way, I think what we're really trying to affirm in this process is the agency of individuals while also acknowledging the brokenness of systems. So we have these systems that, you know, it's often reversed. It's like, well, the individual is to blame. This person screwed up. They're a loser. But just what was their experience? You know, what were their struggles? Why did they make the choices they made? What were the other options? What were the opportunities? And I just find that, you know, we all are sinners and saints in various measures. So, but if a person is only focused on the why an individual is to blame for their situation or their experiences, or they've just had so many experiences, there's people of my own family that don't talk to each other, you know, and there's nothing I could do as a Miracle Messages founder CEO that will get those two individuals to talk. They have their own history and their own story, but at least giving them the chance that they know a service like this exists if and when they're ready for it, I think is a way of respecting the individuals and the relationship in a way that's not often done right now.
What do you think reconciliation looks like? Because I'm thinking of people in relationships in my family that are hard. When I met my father again for the fourth time or so, oh gosh, it's still hard. When I've been trying to build a relationship with him over these years, when I see him not wanting to hold all that stuff, that history that's between us, and have it influence how we're engaging now. That is really, really hard.
There's a saying, I believe it's a Zulu greeting, where instead of like, how are you, when you greet each other, it's Sawubona, which translates to mean, I see you. And the response is something like, I feel seen, or I see you too. And I just wonder how much of the brokenness that we find in our relationships are this vestige of our culture where it feels like it's a winner takes all. You can't feel seen at the exclusion of someone else not being seen. Like if you're seeing one person is being seen, the other person can't be. It's a winner and a loser. It's that dichotomy. And I just wonder
that there's not space for.
Yeah, both. I just wonder what it would look like to have two parties that may disagree, may choose to not continue a relationship, but they both feel seen by the other person. They can both look at each other in the eye and say, I may not agree. This is painful. It's going to conjure too many memories constantly. There's stuff that I can't forgive or forget. But I feel that you have seen the experience in its truth that I lived it. And that's a starting point.
Yeah.
It's not just the person's words to the other. I'm sorry. I love you. It's not just the expression one way. It's you see the vulnerability of the person often, especially if it's a video or even an audio recording, or even the act of recording it is an act of vulnerability, right? I mean, if I was fighting with a friend and I wrote them a letter, it could be an awful letter. And we try to make sure it's not an awful letter. We say, I don't know if you want to bring up the $10,000 they owe you right now. Why don't we wait on that? But the fact of reaching out is an act of almost arms open. So I think we all want to be seen, and we all often don't feel seen. And so finding ways to create space where two individuals can feel like they see each other in a thoughtful, respectful way without discounting the trauma and the pain that one or both have experienced, I think is a starting point to reconciliation.
It sounds like what I'm hearing is being able to hold both.
It's so important in this time as much as all others. Before this call, I was watching some videos of the protests the last few days around police brutality. And the video, there's some shocking, horrible stuff of seeing what, many African-Americans and individuals of color have experienced at the hands of police and systems of injustice more broadly. I mean, it's beyond that. But the police as a manifestation of like, can you trust the police or not? And it's a very different experience for different people in this country. So how do you account for the very real and very different experiences that so many people in this country have faced that so many others may be oblivious to, while still creating that space for hope that we are in this together? And if that we can see things, even if it's not the same experience, if we can see each other's experiences, there's an opportunity to truly be part of the greater whole together. And then the other video was this sweet little like 2-year-old, 3-year-old girl going around at this concert, this little African-American girl, just hugging everyone. You know, every single person she just hugs someone, and then she goes to the next person, hugs someone else. And I just often think about this in my work with the homeless. What have we lost or forgotten as adults? Because for good reason, because systems are screwed up, because we've had poor experiences, because, it's not to dismiss those experiences or that pain and kind of, but to see like a child who's just so open, going around, hugging every single person, old, young, regardless of skin color. It's a reminder of what we forget. And in the work I do with the homeless, when I got those videos back of people experiencing homelessness wearing the cameras around their chests, the other thing that came to mind, aside from, I never realized I was homeless when I lost my housing, only when I lost my family and friends, is seeing how children act with people on the streets and almost flip a coin how their parents respond. Every single kid in every single video looks back, mom, why is that man on the streets? Tugs at the mom, goes up to the person. Half the time, the parent drags them away and scolds them. Bad, dangerous, don't do that. The other half of the time, they let the child guide them to that individual. And there's almost like this implicit awareness that the child has remembered something that we've forgotten. And it's more so Christ-like. Good. It really is, So I'm a very optimistic, hopeful person, but we have to understand the lived experiences we have to feel seen. But in order to what? In order to rectify these wrongs, but also to build a more therapeutic community together as one people, because we are all people.
I love that idea that we're building a therapeutic community together. That's really beautiful. One thing that has come to mind with all of this work is we do have this perception of people who are experiencing homelessness that they are bad, that something got them to where they are, and that maybe they're in addiction, and so all the efforts we're putting in isn't actually going to be helpful. But something that you and I had talked about was this idea that people are not defined by their worst deed. And I think that's kind of been part of your work as well, is challenging not just the overall public perception, but even on a deep personal perception between people who are trying to reconcile. And because it has been so many years, I mean, gosh, 15 years, if my dad hypothetically came around after 15 years, I definitely have a sort of an affront to that idea.
It's brings to mind one of my favorite phrases of hurt people hurt people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the starting point for that is hurt people hurt themselves.
Wow. Yeah, that's such a good way to say it.
You know, when we record a message from a person on the streets and they say, I want to reconnect, and then they change their mind, the most common reason that they cite for changing their mind, I can't, I feel dirty. And
wow.
This internalized sense of worthlessness and self-loathing and shame and just, I'm not even good enough. I don't want to be a burden, literally. And that's a common refrain. I don't want to be a burden. I don't want to bring shame on them. I don't want them to hate me or hurt them any further. And they say, the only thing I wish people knew is that I'm the only person I'm a danger to is myself.
Wow.
And so I do think that, you know, it's, you know, we have such access to self-care and self-compassion and therapy and workshops and yoga and friendships. And, you know, you could call me, I could call you if I'm having a bad day and just kvetch. Who does a person experiencing homelessness have, and what resources? Do they even have a phone? Do they have someone who's going to answer if they do have a phone? What kinds of programs of healing and compassion do they have? So it's a broader issue of reducing a human being to one problem that's at the base of Maslow's pyramid of housing. And yes, food, water, shelter, clothing, housing, we need that to be fully human. Absolutely. I can't imagine not having that, right? Huge privilege to have always had that pretty secure. But if you don't have belonging, if you don't have a sense of safety, psychological, physical, emotional safety, if all these other criteria, if you don't feel love, if you don't feel like you could find a purpose and kind of self-actualize, right? Why is a person, just because they don't have a physical housing, any less in need of or capable of offering all these other elements of what it means to be human? There isn't.
You've seen a lot of these conversations go well and then not go well. When I think about reaching out to friendships or relationships that I have that I feel shame around and starting that conversation, I actually have a friend of mine that I'm thinking of that I've been really struggling with reaching out to her and feel very ashamed of doing, like kind of going quiet and not having that face-to-face conversation about why. And so I'm trying to hold myself accountable and mm-hmm. and reach out, but I have to be honest, I've been avoiding it because I don't know where to start. And there are some, I think, ideologies that we disagree on a lot, and I don't know how to get around that. And that's been part of the reason I've also been avoiding it. So I'm just wondering, you kind of have seen so many of these situations. Do you have any advice for me or people who might be listening who are either on either end of the spectrum where they're trying to entertain an idea where someone has come to them to want to rebuild a relationship, or if there is hesitancy and where to start with those hard conversations?
I don't have any advice, but I do have maybe two perspectives to offer. So for what it's worth, it's you characterized the situation with your friend as you haven't been having a conversation with them, but you have.
Yeah.
You've been having a long, very painful conversation with them. It just happens to be without them present. They're probably having a conversation with you too. It's characterized by silence and it's not going super well right now.
Wow.
And it's a conversation you're having with yourself that's not very generous, right? It's, what have I done wrong? Well, wait, these are my values. I'm standing up for my values. Where have they gone wrong? I've grown up, right? Like, you're having this whole soliloquy and no one else is listening. So I would say, I would just say to begin with, you are having a conversation. You're just choosing to not have a conversation with them. And there seems like choosing the same at this time. Probably would be an act of generosity to say, hey, I'm unsettled about this. I'm still having this conversation with myself. Are you? If not, God bless you. But maybe we can have a conversation together. So that's perspective, like, first step. Last step, if you want to just go big, big time picture, taking a moment to, in a Thich Nhat Hanh book I was reading the other day, encourages, if you're having trouble with a person, Thich Nhat Hanh says, think about where they'll be in 300 years and think about where you'll be in 300 years. And suddenly, like, or, you know, you're just like, I mean, I'll be long gone. Will I be remembered? Probably not. Will anyone say my name? Maybe, but unlikely. Like, but this kind of quintessential element of who I am, I hope will carry on, maybe through children, through relationships, through work, through values, through the way I stand up. So even if they don't know my name, it'll continue. So in some ways, it's both an act of, I think, tremendous compassion when I say, gosh, Jessica, like 300 years from now, who will we be? It puts it as the more minutia of what it is, the interpersonal and, you know, conflict. But it also gives me a chance to say, even if this is painful, what are the values that I want to stand up for now that 300 years I'd like to carry forward as part of my legacy, even if they don't know my name? So, you know, I think those two perspectives would, you know, might be helpful just as a consideration here.
Gosh, I'm smiling and I'm also turning red a little bit because this is so humbling. And I feel I'm just like, I'm going to work up the courage to move through the next step. And it's hard feeling the shame part. It's, I think, easier to be on the other end and be like, I don't know if I accept that. I'm not sure that I'm ready to build that relationship again, but to be on the side that's doing the approaching is really hard. So yeah.
And what you just said, Jessica, is the brilliant, and that would be the third perspective I'd offer, which is, by doing that, you are not only doing something for yourself or for them, you're doing something in solidarity to the wider suffering and vulnerability that so many people face. So the next time that you record a message from a person on the street, so the next time you try to locate their loved one and you're on the phone with the family and they're like, you know, I've had some tough stuff, I don't know if I'm ready, you could say, Salbona, I see you. I get it. I have this friend that I didn't want a lick of time to spend with, and yet they were running through my mind. I was unsettled. I called them. We're not close friends anymore. It's not the same. But I was really glad to have that knowledge that the conversation I could have with them could actually be with them while I had a chance to do it, because we don't know how long we have. So I think that experience set will act as a way of connecting to others who are struggling with similar issues. And we all are at a different level.
I think that there are lessons that we are blind to when we think about that situation. It could be so easy for any one of us, and you've said this in interviews as well, to one paycheck away from also being in a really dire position, like the neighbors and communities that you work with. But there are so many relatable tidbits here to our personal lives, and I think we can forget that. At least I speak for myself. I can forget that when I look at somebody who's experiencing homelessness and think, but I wouldn't be able to understand what they're going through, or vice versa. And it's like, well, no, actually building relationships is hard no matter what situation you're in. In your work, and you personally, how have you kind of processed accepting when someone approaches you to have that reconciliation conversation? What would you say our best disposition could be in those moments?
You know, my mom had a really good phrase. She had passed away about 12 years ago, had breast cancer, and, you know, had a really tough time for many years, but she was kind of like the rock. She was, you know, if we were meeting and we were good friends, or we were dating. I want you to meet her as a better encapsulation of who I am and an embodiment of so many of my values. And I was like, I literally asked her in the ICU before, you know, she went on hospice care for a few days. If you're not here, how can I be me? Because so much of who I am is informed by who you are. But, you know, she had a perspective and she kind of had a colloquialism that I would make fun of her about that has more and more timeless wisdom as the years go on. And she'd say, people are people. And I'd say, oh, Mom, what does that mean? She said, no, people are people. And, you know, she had a pretty tough lot of things. And it was even more painful than I had ever realized that she ever revealed while she was alive. I found out a lot of stuff of trauma and pain that she faced in childhood and growing up, just abuse. It's totally unacceptable that she never shared because she didn't want it to define her. And the little I knew of the pain that she had experienced, even as an adult, I tried to understand, like, why do you forgive this person? Why are you so kind to them? Why are you so generous to them? And she had this perspective, again, encapsulated by this people are people quote, that this person is doing the best that they can do. And the best that they can do may not be very good in the scheme of things, but they just don't have the capacity. They don't have the tools. And so then it's a question of, do you judge them for who they are, which you're totally able to do? Or do you say, this is who they are? Do I want any kind of interaction with them, relationship with them, knowing that I'm always going to have this element that's going to be dissatisfied, or I can't depend on them for this thing, or they're not going to give me that? And that's where, for me, having that initial strength through generosity that I think I learned from my mom, combined with this last year and a half of learning to be my own best friend, learning to get what I call a PhD in myself and how to love myself as I try to love others, has made me feel a lot less dependent on others to validate who I am as a way of affirming my own identity. And so I'm like, well, now I can truly act with this generosity of spirit that I saw so encapsulated by my mom with her people are people kind of mentality, and, you know, worked at nursing homes, older adults, and I just showed up for every single neighbor as an extended part of their family, as someone's mom or as someone's sister. I can do that while still retaining a solidity, a rootedness in who I am that doesn't require their verification. And that combination has felt really life-giving and exciting as a way of then showing up for others that may have pained me, because I realize it's very rarely about me. It has very much more to do with where they're at, and I can just love and accept them as they are if I truly love and accept myself for who I am.
You are a tremendous gift to a lot of people, Kevin, and you, I think you have a humbleness of spirit, which I find so endearing, and so we're so fortunate to have you do the work that you do.
Well,
how can people get involved with everything you're doing? I know there are a lot of volunteer opportunities right now through Miracle Messages. I'm a digital detective, which I'm very proud
of.
Yeah,
you are. You're a really good digital detective. Who knew that Jessica was such a digital stalker? Like, she could just find, it was like on the internet.
I can find you. I will find you.
You will find you.
Yeah.
How can people get involved?
I'm the person to come to. Yeah.
You know, reach out. Don't just be a lurker on our page. Like us on Facebook and all that jazz. But, you know, send a message on miraclemessages.org. Get involved. Say what you're interested in. You could be a digital detective and hang out with Jessica. Which is a fun thing to do. You can join Miracle Friends and get connected and assigned to match with a person experiencing homelessness who's been moved into a hotel as a result of COVID-19, who's probably experiencing a level of isolation, loneliness, and anxiety that, you know, may match or even surpass your own, and build a connection once a week, twice a week, three times a week, have a phone call, text message. So we'll connect you that way if you're interested. But, you know, we're a nonprofit. We're a two-person full-time nonprofit. So donations are always great. If you have a skill set, you know, technology, design, communication, storytelling, video editing, you know, be in touch and let's figure something out. But yeah, start at our website, miraclemessages.org. Yeah, I got to show you my little shirt. Everyone is someone, somebody, right? If you see someone, someone's brother or sister, you just show a lot more respect. And you can even say this to like college students. You know, you go to a college student and God, the experience. Can you imagine being on a college campus and like dating and trying to navigate relationships, right? Like even if you're just like a healthy, just, you know, consent, conversation, it's painful. It's like shame. It's driven. So I think if you start by seeing someone as someone's daughter, someone's sister, like if you see a person on the streets as someone's brother, as someone's mom, we actually are pretty wired to know how to interact with that person. It's not that pain. It's not that complicated. It's just we forget. We take the individual as a part from the collective, the ecosystem. And I think seeing someone as part of a wider whole that has preceded you and will follow, you know, you, that they're part of a community and you're part of that same community, that beloved community or therapeutic community. It's just a quick way to show the respect that people deserve. So
to be continued.
To be continued.
Questions.
We'll do it.
I have so many more questions.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm Jessica Minhas, and thanks for joining us on I'll Go First. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to uplift and support you in your journey of healing. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, comment, and share. And if there's a topic you'd like us to dive deeper into or would like to share your story with us, we are available on all major platforms at I'll Go First and www.illgofirst.com. We'll see you next time.